Hello and welcome to this week's Business Matters on Highland Radio with me, Chris Ashmore. My guest is Kilcar native Rory Gallagher, singer, songwriter and businessman who now lives in the Canary Islands. His business journey has certainly seen plenty of twists and turns, from his days with the Revs and touring Europe and Australia to gigging and then setting up a bar in Lanzarote, returning to Ireland and then opening the bar in Scotland just as COVID hit. Well, nowadays he's back in Lanzarote once more, where he runs three bars along with his wife Cara. I met him recently over in Lanzarote to take a look at how his career has all panned out, and he certainly has an interesting story to tell. Rory, delighted to be talking to you on Business Matters. We are on the lovely sunny island of Lanzarote, nice and warm. This is essentially your home now. You know it like the back of your hand, but let's just rewind first of all. How did you first come to Lanzarote, and when did you actually first think of actually trying to establish a business here?
Well, it was back in 2005 and 2006. We played two charity festivals that were being run by a guy called Charlie Chapman, who used to have a very famous venue here called Charlie's. It was kind of like one of the first big Irish places over here. And Charlie invited us over. We were in the Revs. And the second year, one of the committee of the organisers was called Cara McGee from Scotland, and she is now my wife. So it was the second time I was over. We were actually supporting Johnny Logan the second time. That was a weird combination. It was the Revs and Johnny Logan, and I just got on great with Cara, and every time I got like €150, I would try and get a Ryanair and come over for a week. And so she started getting me gigs in the bar that she was working, called the Brian Baru, and I just kind of, I'd been doing the Revs, but the Revs were starting to hit a brick wall for a year or two, and it wasn't getting to the next step that you need to be getting to for an original act. And the main thing that happens there is you've got no money coming in, and we had no record company. So to actually be able to go and play the pubs again for like €150 was amazing, you know. And I realised, oh my God, you can do that six nights a week over here if you want. Back then, you know, it was easier, but easier. And so basically I... you know, everything kind of fell into place with Cara, and we were going to move back home, and we said, well, do you know what, we'll stay in Lanzarote first, see how that goes, because at least I know I've got music income coming in there. And so that was 2006, and probably about 6.5 years later we opened up our own music bar called the Island Bar. That's how it all came about, really.
And back in 2006, of course, with the Celtic Tiger at home, there was a lot of Irish people coming out here. And I think I read Lanzarote still gets 440,000 Irish tourists a year. It's probably the most popular sun destination for the Irish.
It seems to be, yeah. It's nice. Like, it feels like a home from home here. And, you know, what a lot of people like about Lanzarote is it kind of has everything. It goes from 5-star to 1-star. So if you want to have a low-budget hoolie with a stag party or a hen party, that's there. You know, there's that kind of a... you know, there's a middle ground to it if you want to come over with a family, and then there's if you want to go really high grade and be more cultural and, you know, go to the other beaches on the island. So it's great that it has everything, you know, and that's what I love about it.
So the first business, the first bar, red tape, voyage into the unknown, how difficult was that?
It was difficult, but it kind of felt like... you know, not being arrogant, but I kind of knew that, like, in the places I was playing at the time, I was bringing in 60, 70 people a night that I'd built up through Facebook over the years from repetitively gigging week after week for 6-7 years over here. So it felt like a kind of a safe gamble. Like, but we didn't actually think it would go as well as it went the first time. You know, it was, so we were expecting maybe like 40, 50 people a night, and it turned into like 100, 120 people a night. And and we were honoured to be, you know, basically.
And then, no doubt, you found that the repeat business was people coming back every summer or every Easter or two or three times a year, familiar faces.
Yeah, it became like that. And I'm terrible, because I'm good with faces but terrible with names, you know. And so I would meet somebody maybe like three times a year for 4 years, and then all of a sudden they bring over a cousin and they're going like, "Are you not going to introduce me?" You know, and I'm like, oh, you know, and I can't think of their name, because there's just so many names. But no, really good repeat custom here. And I think if you always try and, you know, keep, probably like any business, if you keep a good standard, you know, people will come back. Rory, in the bar business, sort of, how much experience did you have? How much was sort of new to you?
Well, to be honest, and I'm kind of guilty being on this show, is it should be my wife speaking into this microphone, because she was the one that's, she's the bar trade. And, you know, I've always been in the music business, and just having a good idea of keeping my eyes on figures and stuff. But Cara, she's been working in pubs since she was 15 years old in restaurants, and so she has all the experience. She kind of knew the ins and outs. She's the one that did the research when it comes to accountants and RSFA and getting our figures right, making sure we're never in any trouble. So she would be the sensible brains behind the operation. I'm more of an ideas man, and 90% of the ideas, she goes, we can't afford that idea that you just thought of.
One of the big plus points, I suppose, being in business in Lanzarote is it's pretty much a year-round economy here. It's not like maybe the south of France or parts of Spain where you only have the April to October window. You have people coming out here all year round, and indeed August is one of the quieter months.
Yeah, I would find that even June, July, August, you know, everybody would be rubbing their hands thinking, here we go, it's summertime. But what you're getting then is a lot of people coming over with their families. It's that mid-range holiday where they might be all-inclusive, and rightly so, if you can do it. So we don't get as much trade in the bars because people are staying near the swimming pool, they have kids. They're not really going out to late-night shows in bars, you know. And so it is a weird time, and also because the flights are so cripplingly expensive at that time of year, you know, you'll get much better deals in February and March, and that's our good time for people that like to spend 180 on a flight and, you know, 300 in a bar.
And although, like everywhere, the cost of inputs have gone up an awful lot, food prices everywhere have risen, but if you like a drink in Lanzarote, the drink prices haven't risen as much.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a great advantage that they have, where they have this autonomo political thing with the Canary Islands, where it's in the EU but it's not in the EU, you know, it's when it suits them. So they kind of call a lot of their own shots when it comes to VAT on alcohol and things like that, and that's possibly a thing that Ireland could have looked at in the past, and I don't know, is it ever possible again? Because, you know, people do like to come to Ireland for a pint of Guinness, and then it's terrible when you go to Ireland for a pint of Guinness, and the pint of Guinness now is like €9 in places, and it's not the way it should be, you know. And so over here there's such a low you know, tax duty markup, all that kind of thing, VAT, that you can actually, you know, you see a lot of places giving out a pint for €1.50 during the daytime, and that is actually possible. You're still making a couple of cent on that, you know.
And it's very much like a lot of other businesses. At the end of the day, it's a numbers game. It's about getting the feet through the door.
That's it, yeah. I mean, a lot of that, you see breakfasts over here for maybe €3, and you know, that's a break-even breakfast, but they're hoping that they make the money on the tea and the coffee, and maybe that the girlfriend will have a nicer breakfast with avocado, and, you know, so, you know, you are trying to... You put out maybe a false number that, like, you know, you could put out, say, a pint for €1.50, but that you're maybe making 20 cents on that, but you're hoping that the other person is drinking a vodka and Coke.
So, Rory, growing up, you're from a very musical family, so that was, I suppose, in many respects, it was part of the DNA.
Oh, completely, yeah. I always say I'm the least talented person in my house. So, growing up in Kilcar and that, and, you know, it's a great luxury, and I wish I could have done, well, it's not too late yet, but I wish I could do it more for my kids, where when you grow up in rural Ireland, you know, you take it for granted that you can make a lot of noise, you know. Not a lot of houses are connected, so I would have had drums and you know, guitar amps, bass amp, piano, everything in the house all the time. So from the age of like 2.5, I was tinkering, you know, at a loud volume if I wanted to. And I always find that with my own boys, Aidan and Shay, you know, just with the, as you say, the life goes on, you know, cost of living goes up. I found that we were living in estates and they had thin walls, and so it was actually very hard for me. I could never put a drum kit into our house, and even still, you know, and so to have that luxury of being in Kilcar and being in rural Ireland and being able to make noise, and then we were forming bands with, you know, boys at school and cousins of mine when I was 11 or 12, playing Metallica, Megadeth, Nirvana, as loud as we wanted, and it was great. And you know, for my father then, he set up his own recording studio in the attic, and for me to learn all about Pro Tools at an early age, and, you know, just ins and outs of the microphones, the cables, the different XLRs, all the connections, and it was great. You know, I went to rock school when I was 18 and realised that I didn't need to go to rock school in Ballyfermot because I had it the whole time in Kilcar, you know.
And just remind us again of your parents and their musical background.
Yeah, well, they were playing music since the early 70s when they first met up and got married, and they had a band called Pluto. Pluto was doing very well, you know, around that time of Love Bug and Royal Flush, all those bands. They used to kind of before DJs, you know, a band would play on a Saturday night and do all the hits of the week. You know, it was probably the follow-on. I don't need to explain this to anybody in Donegal. It would have been the follow-on for the show band times. And it was great. You know, we had brilliant five-piece live music bands playing in all the big clubs all around Ulster. And so my parents were in that. And then that kind of faded away. And luckily enough, they were talented enough that they kind of switched to more country and Irish. And we were doing a lot of work, actually, in the UK and the USA, you know. And I was kind of there nearly all the time. You know, I might have been selling CDs, and which helped with, you know, with the maths and the business, and just and seeing the nature of people. So I would have been helping them out like that, and then I was drumming with them sometimes. And you know, probably a double-edged sword. It was tough sometimes when you're 14 years old and you have to do a week over in Cumbria, and all your friends are going to maybe discos in Slane Castle and things like that. But at the same time now, I've no regrets. You know.
Yeah. And was it pretty much a search as you were coming up to leaving certain age that I'm going down the music avenue?
It wasn't really a search, you know, because I think there's I don't know if it's a trait in the Gallaghers or the Cannons and my thing, but we're quite can be quite obstreperous and rebellious. And weirdly enough, I was going to become an English teacher, because that's how you rebel against musical parents, you know. And my father was kind of going, come on, you're good at music, you can do anything. I was like, no, I'm going to go to university and study to become an English teacher. So that was my form of rebellion, you know. And I didn't get the points in the leaving cert, so I put back on the guitar.
Did you want to be in a band, or did you want to go solo in those early years?
I wasn't really sure. I was playing solo in the pubs and stuff, but I thought that at the time, you know, it wasn't where the whole market is flooded at the minute with Ed Sheeran's and Hoziers, and you know, one piece wasn't such a big thing. If you can remember that, remember that in the late 90s, it was all bands. It was, you know, Pulp, Oasis, Blur, and so I kind of went, well, you know, I was into Green Day at the time, and so you know, I got chatting to Mickey D. O'Donnell in Kilcar, and he was saying he knew a good musician that played the guitar, and we had a rehearsal, and within a month we were the Revs, and that we went on to tour Europe and Australia and got to open at Slane Castle and play in Witness and support Oasis and Muse, and great days, you know.
Does that seem a long time ago now?
It does, yeah. But it is a long time ago. I'm old. That was 25 years ago. It's a different life, you know. You know, it is that thing of like, if I know now what, you know, if I knew back then what I know now, we could have made it work a bit better. But that's life, you know. You can't, there's no point looking back. Don't look back in anger.
And you had, of course, a couple not that long ago, you had a reunion.
We did, yeah. We did two shows. We hadn't played in 10 years, so we did one in Whelan's, and that sold out. So we did another one in the, was it the Ambassador or the Academy? Slightly bigger venue. So we did those two. But then we were kind of chatting among ourselves, and John said he had no real wish to continue this nostalgia. So we were like, okay, but we actually have our own WhatsApp group, and we're still good friends. And you never know, there might be a gig or two on the horizon. But even that was 2016, so that'll soon be 10 years ago. Maybe it'll be a 10-year reunion of the 10-year reunion.
Rory, fair to say that business is a constant learning curve. If we rewind back to sort of 2015, 2016, you were beginning to settle down and kids then arrived, and you're thinking, you know, where do I go? Will I go back to Ireland? Were you going to go to Scotland with your wife? There was a lot going on, so you had some decisions to make.
Yeah, we did. You know, on reflection now, we were totally burnt out in the island. You know, I think we were kind of exhausted before we opened our first bar. You know, when anybody knows, when you're living over here and you're younger, there's a lot of drinking goes on in Lanzarote or any place like this. So we had done like 6 years and then opened up our own business and kind of continued it, you know. And all of a sudden, when babies arrive, they put manners on you. So we had to start behaving ourselves. And I think it was like we had been over here for like maybe, I think I was over for 11 years, something. Cara was over for longer than that, and it was that kind of like, oh, you know, island fever. It was just too much, wanted to get away. So we moved back to Donegal,
And when we were back in Kilcar, we were looking at places that were shut down to reopen them, like the Piper's Rest in Kilcar. We tried to get the papers of that.
What year are we talking about, roughly?
This was 2018, the end, beginning of 2019. So we were looking at the Piper's Rest. We were looking at the clock tower out in Fintra, beside Killybegs. And nothing was really falling into place that made sense for us money-wise without a big refurb and reconstruction and having to purchase a property. And all of a sudden, we're only settled for about 7 or 8 months when this opportunity came up in Edinburgh City Centre for a small live music venue. And Cara was from Edinburgh originally, and we went, oh my God, like, are we going to have to up and leave again? But we went, you know what, we'll nip it in the bud now before it's too late. So we moved over to Edinburgh after having only been in Ireland for less than a year. And we were just getting sorted there, getting everything ready to open, and the global pandemic hit. So that put an end to that bar. That was called the Wildcat. That was open for about 3 days. And then because we were new to the UK, we hadn't, I'll try and put this in the best legal terms, we hadn't properly entered the system of the UK. So we weren't getting all the benefits that we should have during COVID. And the landlord of the building of the Wildcat in Edinburgh, he said he's going to freeze the rent. And when he said freeze, that's not writing off the rent through the government or anything. So this was, I think it was 4,500 sterling a month. So all of a sudden the months went on and on and on. So by the third month we were like, oof, we're about 13,000 sterling in the hole here, and there seemed to be no end in sight. So we handed back the keys, and a lot of people said, no, you're panicking, but I'm glad now we did, because it really didn't come around properly for a year and a half, if you remember it back then.
And during this time, you needed income, of course. Online, you were certainly active.
Yeah, I remember at the time just that total panic where, you know, we weren't getting the dole, and it was like, okay. So I went to do a driving test for Amazon, to do Amazon deliveries. That was one of the big things during COVID. So I went out in the transit, did my thing out in Bathgate, West Lothian, and got my little certificate, and I was all set to do this. But I was seeing like it was horrendous work for about €200 a week. Once all said and done, I was like, oof. So that evening, Cara said to me, there's loads of people doing these Facebook Live gigs. You know, you should give it a go. Just put up the tip jar, see how it goes. And I made more in an hour and a half on Facebook than I would have driving a van for 6 days a week. So I went, okay, I'm going to reconcentrate on the music and figure out how to do this computer stuff online, you know.
You're listening to Business Matters on Highland Radio with me, Chris Ashmore. I'm speaking with Donegal man Rory Gallagher about his career in the music and entertainment industry. Coming up, we'll hear more about the three bars that he runs with his wife Cara in Lanzarote, his songwriting, revenue from music in this online world, live gigs, the GAA, and how he has learnt so much in business, including overcoming bumps in the road that crop up along the way. So tell me about when it comes to writing songs. You've had a number of pretty big hits. Do some of them come quicker than others when you sit down? Do you have a formula there? Does a seed get planted and you nurture it?
Yeah, it's totally like a seed for me, where it just comes with a little catchy hook, and it might only last like 11 seconds. So I would record that into my phone. It could be like a little statement, or just a little combination of notes, and I would kind of base the song off that little thing that I got into, you know, something that I can't get out of my head. I'm thinking, well, if I can't get it out of my head, hopefully a lot of other people can't get it out of their head as well. And I normally base things around a small hook like that. So I've got loads of little 30-second recordings on my phone that I'll have an idea when I'm walking or driving, and I just have to get it out. And that's normally how I do it. And it's funny, like, because, people say, like, oh, you know, you're both doing very well in business, and then the business seems to be going well for you. And I noticed, like, writing songs and being in business is very similar, because, you know, when you're younger, you think, oh, this has to be a great song, it has to be a hit. And you get so used to songs failing. You get so used to failing, you know, like I have, I think, 115 songs written, registered on IMRO. I have 93 on Spotify. People probably only know about four of them. Most people only know
one and a half of them. Maybe Jimmy's winning matches and wired to the moon. You know, so you get so used to failure that it just becomes second nature. And I think that's so essential in business. You know, like we've had a lot of things that haven't worked for us, and you just dust yourself on and get on with it. But I see a lot of people, like some of my friends and stuff, they never get over the first thing that failed. And I think that's a real error. It's just nobody cares. People are too busy with their own lives to worry about what's going wrong with yours, you know.
And from a let's phrase it, from a money-making point of view, the music business now, it's a completely different world than when you were with the Revs, when you were doing your first record deal. People were going in and buying a bit of vinyl. Fast forward to now, where is the revenue stream? Is it through Spotify mainly, or
it's really, really bad? You know, I think you know, that's why you see people promoting their own gigs live so much, and say bands like the Tumbling Paddies, Whistling Donkeys, that are, you know, doing well, but they're working so hard. You know, and a friend of mine like Sean McGee, and even all the people I know that play in the pubs, they have to play a lot, you know, because in the past, like, you would go into a studio for maybe, say, €250, you might get like 10 acoustic tracks done, and then you could sell that CD. You would print the CD for €1 and sell it for 10, and you might sell 3 or 4 of them after a gig. So that's an extra €40 a night. And if you're gigging 5 nights a week, it becomes €200 a week. And it was a little self-sufficient thing. You didn't have to be a big act, you know. And even the Revs, we were only selling, say, 10,000 CDs, but that was €100,000 coming in. That's disappeared. You know, Spotify now, 1 million plays on Spotify will get you about $2,000. But then they make up excuses, going, well, a lot of these plays wasn't the full 4 minutes, it was only 2 minutes, so you get 50 cent knocked off here and there, blah, blah. So a lot of the time my Spotify at the end of the year is about maybe €600, and it costs that for 2 days in a studio now.
And likewise, YouTube, there is a revenue stream, but again, it's a big numbers game.
It is, yeah, and I think you need to be doing them kind of Muppety kids videos where it's just, you know, people chasing around in Roblox and shouting at each other with dyed hair, and, yeah, you know, you need to, like, put your kid up, like, you know, the mother put up Ryan's World, and it's a weird thing, you know, and you need to go into the millions and the billions to be making money, and I find that whole thing very annoying. I find TikTok annoying, I find YouTube annoying, but it's kind of a necessary evil at the minute. You have to dip your toe in it sometimes, you know.
But maybe the upside of it is there's a lot more live music on, because that's where the revenue is.
Yeah, and it'll serve it well, because people have to be good live again. The only problem I'm finding is people's attention span, the younger generation, has gone with TikTok and YouTube and all that. So every act is having to play the same 28 songs. You know, you have, you know, Grace, Hills Donegal, Travelling Soldier, and it becomes this where everybody's playing the same set, where like 25 years ago, it was a kind of a badge of honour if you had a different set to the band that was down the road from you, you know. So that's one thing that I hope switches in the music business.
No doubt, Rory, you have your own personal favourite songs, and when you're playing in front of a loud audience, and you've touched on it there, the younger generation attention span, and some of the ones that get the most reaction, I mean, your dear friend Michael O'Leary's even featured.
The Ryanair Blues, yeah. Sometimes when you're playing a long set over here, sometimes the set is 3 hours. I find a bit of comic levity helps, you know, so I'd throw in like Ryanair Blues and songs about, silly songs about my wife, or just like nonsense, you know, and it kind of helps. And even Jimmy's Winning Matches was a novelty song, you know, it's meant to be a bit of comedy that got way out of hand, you know. So, and the thing is, like, I can't really play. I couldn't go out and put my hand on my heart and play 100% set that I want to play, because it's holiday makers and they want to have a good time. And I'm very lucky that, like, I have that gene in me where I like seeing people having a good time. So it works in a circle. If I see people having a good night, I don't mind what I'm playing a lot of the time.
So tell me now, if here we are, 2025, back on the island, and a different establishment.
Yeah, so we
as I say, we had all this COVID trouble, and we opened up a second place in Edinburgh. We gave it one more shot. We were, we can do this. And it was just one of those, it was Bar 13, it was called, and it was well named. It was like number 13 on the street. So we said, like, we would play with the superstition. It doesn't mean anything, not into that. Called it Bar 13, and everything went wrong. It was just, we hadn't really looked properly at the plumbing, the piping, the community taxes, the even things like Edinburgh parking. But the biggest thing was, there was five neighbours upstairs, and they had this weird clause. It's nearly unheard of, especially in the likes of Glasgow and Dublin, where they had 0 decibel spill allowed from other businesses. So we had the Edinburgh Council in at us every night with their little decibel meter. So I started my gigs at 10 o'clock, then I switched it down to 9, and I was playing at 8. So by the end, I was playing at 5:30 in the evening, and we were still getting complaints from upstairs, and it was like, it was just going nowhere. So we went, but we'd actually put a lot of money into it, like a lot of investment. We'd taken out a 10-year loan, which we're still be paying back for the next 8 years. But it was one of those, it's, you got to know when to hold them, when to fold them. And it was like, that this could cripple us, you know. So we said, like, you know what, we have a bit of a hold on things over in Lanzarote. We know what we're doing over there. And the Irish Viking had come up, and we had a chance to take it. So we said, you know what, one more gamble. So we went for it. I don't, the more I'm speaking to you, the more I'm thinking we have a problem, you know.
Well, when you came back then out to Lanzarote, the Irish Viking, centrally located, was it a case of sort of hitting the ground running almost straight away?
It was, yeah, because luckily enough, I had been still gigging in the Spinnaker Bar, which good Donegal friends of mine, the Browns, and I had been over doing the Spinnaker every couple of months, and that was getting such a great reaction still. And I was like, oh, and Cara was going, well, you still seem to have a following in Lanzarote, even though you haven't been there since 2018. And I was like, I know, yeah, I think I managed to hold them through the Facebook Lives and that communication. And then we opened up a small bar, which is a kind of dipping our toes in the water, called Rory's Corner Bar. And I played there once or twice, and it was carnage. The place holds about 48, and I think 148 showed up. So it was just got really out of hand, and the police were called, and we were like, you know what, the potential is there, but the bar's not right. So the Viking came up. We were like, okay, we can do this. So we had the Viking, and the problem with the Viking is it's kind of like an old shebeen, where it's broken into 3 or 4 sections, and we thought we'd be able to toss a wall, but we were told by the council we couldn't, so we couldn't toss any walls. So we went, okay, so we still had to keep looking. So the Viking is still running away as itself, and it's going fine. It's a great small live music venue and Gaelic football and all that. But we took another place with a bigger lounge, and that is now Rory's Live Lounge. So that's where I am at the moment.
And that's in Puerto del Carmen.
Yes, yeah, so we have 3 places now by mistake. We have the Irish Viking, we have Rory's Corner Bar, and Rory's Live Lounge. They're all in Puerto del Carmen, and they're all tipping away nicely, thank God.
So you're becoming a multinational.
a multi-stress head. I think that, you know, as I said, it's totally accidental. It's just one of those things that the Irish Viking music room was yet again getting too packed when I was gigging there. So we just needed somewhere that maybe held more like 140, 150 people. More similar to the old Ireland bar that we had 10 years ago. And then that's what I'm doing now. That is the Live Lounge.
Is it a case of the grass is always greener on the other side? People come out here on holidays, they see a bar, and people kind of get this notion, oh, I could do that. I'll come out, I'll open a bar. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes. And people expect, I know you're up there performing night after night, but in reality, people can't be in holiday mode all the time.
I know, yeah. It's kind of like an art in itself that you develop over the years, where you, I might get bad news from home, you know, that there might be a death, or there might be like somebody's really sick, and you have to kind of slap yourself on the face half an hour before you go on stage and splash a bit of water on. And it is a very old-fashioned form of entertainment that I never thought I would be doing. It's more like, you know, the early Beatles or vaudeville, where you have to have a happy face. It is that, you know, you get on with the show, and you kind of think, well, it's somebody's been working the whole year at home, they've been in a job they're not that happy with, and they've been really looking forward to this week, and it's their first night. they don't want to see you going out and telling how annoyed you are with politics, and you know, it's like that's not your place anymore. So it's something I've developed over the years, and as I say, Cara's the one that should be speaking to you more here about business, but Cara will tell you, like, she's up at 7:30 in the morning and she can be in the bars and she's sorting out the deliveries and the orders and making sure the till's okay from the night before. And because it's Lanzarote, you're getting constant warnings about water shortages, electrical outages, blah, blah. So it's like a very, very stressful. It's like Cara says to me, she goes, "Rory, I think we need a wife." You know, there is that thing of it's 24/7, and it really isn't easy, but you can kind of carve it out where you have 2 hours a day where you might be able to go for a walk, and it's nice weather, you can relax, and that's what you base it around, just trying to get an hour or two for yourself every day.
So you have to pace yourself. Are you singing 7 nights a week?
I'm singing 6 nights a week most of the time, yeah. And even at that, like, in a way, when I was younger, I used to go horse a lot, and I realise now that had a lot to do with drinking, you know. So I've... And it's very difficult on the voice, you know, even if you're not drinking, to do it 6 nights a week. And a lot of the shows are 3 hours, and I'm singing a lot of covers, so there's a lot of high singing going on. And there's, as you say, there's so much discipline. And you know, you might have a Jägermeister on stage, but you've got to be very careful that for every one or two of them you have, you drink a full bottle of water. And it's quite regimented, you know. And people think we're on holiday all the time, and couldn't be further from it.
Yeah. Rory, being from Kilcar, Gaelic football part of the DNA as well, Donegal of course reaching the final against the Kingdom, who came out on top, but GAA is good for Rory in business.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky with that hit that I had, the Jimmy's winning matches back in 2012, you know. Hard to believe it'll soon be 14 years ago. And but even before that, you know, I always had a keen interest in... It's weird because growing up, when I was like 11, 12, 13, I was more into soccer, really, and got a lot of slagging, you know, being in Kilcar for being into soccer, because my father was from Killybegs, Shamey Coleman territory, you know, so he was more actually into soccer. And you know, it was around the time of Jack Charlton and all that, and even though all my friends were into to soccer and all that as well, they were still more staunchly into the Gaelic, you know. And I was like, I think because I wasn't very good at it, and I got like a really bad wrist injury when I was about 12, and my father said, "Listen, you're a lot better at music than you are at football, so I think you should concentrate on the music." And he was right, you know. So I was only ever a spectator of the Gaelic, and but it was always there. And it's only when you go away from home, when I was going over to the States and Australia, and you realise how big it is, and how proud of a thing it is, you know. And I became immersed in it, you know, as the years went on, to the fact where I was writing songs about it when I was 30 years old, you know.
And you are almost sort of the go-to person now if Donegal are going well and about to get to a final.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been brilliant. Just that song, it brings people into the Irish Viking on a Sunday, and I'm looking forward to even the league starting up again, and we have it all set up with the GAA Plus, and you know, we have it. It's great. That's such a great service worldwide, you know, where you can pay it and pay for it properly, get a live stream, and it's broadcast worldwide, because that's a big issue for businesses over here. Is we actually don't mind pay. You would love to pay, because if you're using Fire Sticks, all this here, you know, the mod cons, you're actually 2 minutes behind the score. So we try and avoid that. We would get 3 meter dishes trying to get real signals, even if it's from BN Sports in Saudi Arabia, because a lot of people, they can be very disappointed if it's a true Donegal fan or Liverpool fan or whatever, and the team scores and it comes through on their phone and they don't see it on the screen for another minute and a half. It's very frustrating and dangerous if you're a gambler.
And what about the Donegal players and Jim McGuinness and the backroom team? Do you know many of them well?
Well, Jim has you know, come up to me the odd time and said, "Oh my God, will you stop singing that song?" My head's melted, people shouting it at him in the streets in London and Dublin and everything, you know. But he's funny about it, you know, and he's just kind of being modest, really, because he always likes to push more of the thing on the team. The team do the hard work, you know. But any time I meet any of the players, even ex-Donegal players, they all like have a wee smirk for me, and there's a kind of an understanding there that something special and fluky happened, and it was good you know, good morale booster. And probably the weirdest thing out of it all is I originally wrote the song with Jimmy Selling Watches, and it was about Jimmy Barry Murphy, or Bambo Mohammed, his real name, from Senegal. And I wrote that song, you know, he used to come into the Cracking Call in Charlie's, and so I would sing that chorus when he would walk in. I just wrote it about him the same way I wrote songs about like Louis Walsh or different people, Mad Dog Call. But he went a bit weird about it after a couple of years, because he started telling people that he wrote the original Jimmy's Selling Watches, that that's his song, not really getting it, or possibly getting it and trying to get a pity side of people. So it's a shame that we kind of fell out that way, because he was trying to claim the original song, and it just got very messy. But I see him on the streets sometimes, and it's not anything malicious, but like, I just kind of wish that we could get on with it, you know.
Going forward, any plans for opening more bars, or is there a limit to sort of a number that you can control? Because the more you have, the more problems as well, and the more management.
Yeah, I mean, I think three is plenty, to be honest. Cara will agree, you know, she's the one that has to do the books and the staffing, and I think we have 18 staff at the moment, and it's just it's getting more and more stressful. Yeah, everything's getting. Anyone will tell you in business, you know, things are so digital now. There's no real leeway with anything, and it's like the Beatles song, you know, "Let me tell you how it will be." There's one for you, 19 for me, because I'm the tax man, you know. And we seem to spend most of our time just to trying to appease the tax man.
And from a business perspective, okay, maybe you're not doing all the paperwork, but your overall impressions, you know, compared with the UK or Ireland, is Spain a good place to do business?
It is. Like, the thing is, it's more socialist here. It's a socialist government, especially in the Canaries, so they're very into fully paid sick days. You know, the workers' rights are huge over here, which you kind of get used to. You know, at home it's probably a bit more regimented. But the good thing is they kind of meet you in the middle over here, where the workers have more rights, but then the business owners have a few more, like, as I said, there's less VAT on alcohol, things like that. So it all kind of comes around. Like, I don't notice much difference. I did, like, 15 years ago over here, it was like the Wild West. It was great, you know, it was so cash central. But that's gone now. Like, we're using digital tills, everybody is, and it's connected, which is quite weirdly to the mainframe in Arrecife. So they're actually, they're basically looking at to the point of what you're earning, and it's probably because it's such a small island, the accountants and the taxmen are very strict over here now compared to what it would have been 15 years ago. So you do miss the glory days, you know.
Cash is always king, but we live in an age now that I'm sure you see it in the bar. I mean, have you any idea what percentage, who's tapping now?
I think tapping is probably 80% now. And probably dangerous as well for a lot of people. Like, the younger ones, they don't realise that, like, a lot of places are starting to do that Temple Bar thing where they might switch the prices at 10 o'clock at night. You know, and young, we would never do that, but, like, you know, I find that quite cruel, where some drink that costs €3 can all of a sudden become €5 after 10:30 at night. The old Temple Bar trick, you know. And that's... it's terrible to see that coming in, but, like, that's why I would maybe use cash more if you can when you're on holiday.
Well, as somebody who's got the experience of doing business out here, if you were giving advice to somebody back home who was maybe thinking of going abroad to try something, you need luck, you need a good head on you, and I suppose a bit of market research and getting the background is important.
Yeah, completely. I think probably the most important thing is that you're not putting all your money into the thing straight away. I don't know if that's a natural business rule, but, like, if you come into €100,000 and you decide to open a bar, you know, don't put €100,000 into the bar. You know, try and get something, and you still have a nest egg, because you'll struggle for the first 6 months, no matter what it is. You know, so you do need that, where you're not panicking about rent and basic necessities. And I've seen a lot of people. I say 90% of the people I've seen, they've lasted here for 2 years. They've just come over and they're maybe blowing an inheritance or something, and it's sad to see it. And people get sucked into that. We're like, oh, sure, I'll have a couple of pints myself with the customers, and it doesn't work like that, you know. And nobody can drink 7 days a week. And, so it's, I would say that, and it does have a lot to do with luck as well, you know, and time. And but for me, you know, it's very hard to say that it's luck, because I'd worked, you know, 6 days a week for 6 years before I opened a bar over here. So I had a Facebook following, and it's very important, I think, to have people coming to see you, you know, once you open the doors in the evening. You know, there's nothing worse than an empty bar. Like, nothing attracts a crowd like a crowd, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. What about fear of illness or losing your voice? Can you insure your voice?
No, nothing fancy like that. What I do is normally I have kind of set up where I have some friends or the musicians and that they can step in. We do a thing where we have a sunset session in the Irish Viking, a very talented guy called Ross O'Sullivan. So say if I'm having a bad night and I know I'm not going to be able to perform that night, we would cancel his sunset gig and put him into the nighttime slot. So you always have like have a good sub, you know.
And just wrapping things up, Rory, on the music side of things, still writing away with songs, any particular ambitions, or is there any hurdle out there you'd love to jump over?
You're always probably waiting for the next hit. You know, I'm still writing. I've got about like 11 or 12 demos at the moment. I'm just heading up to a small studio in TS now, and I'm going to do a little bit of recording up there now this afternoon. And yeah, I mean, I put out a song there for the summer, Playa Grande, and fair play to Highland, give it a great old push, and all the places do. And you know, it never be, you very rarely you'll get a major hit like Wire to the Moon or Jimmy's Winning Matches. But you know, if you keep getting minor hits and keep yourself interested, and it's more like I'd be a creative person, so if I'm not being creative, I get a little bit insane and anxious. So it's good to get stuff out of my mind and get it onto paper and onto tape, you know.
And Rory, if people want to keep an eye on what's happening with you and around the bars, your Facebook is probably the best platform.
Yeah, if you go onto Facebook, Rory and the Island, or Instagram, Rory and the Island. I can't use Rory Gallagher because it's been taken by the Ballyshannon legend. So yeah, it's Rory and the Island. That's what I still go under on social media.
Okay, Rory, many thanks for joining us on Business Matters, and we look forward to following your progress with real interest in the years ahead.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks so much.
Well, that's it for this week's Business Matters on Highland Radio with me, Chris Ashmore. Many thanks for listening. If you wish to contact me, the best way is by email, and the address is businessmatters@highlandradio.com. That's businessmatters@highlandradio.com. Until the next time, may I wish you a healthy, happy, and profitable week ahead. Goodbye.